Happy New Year, cricket nerds. A new edition of the Grandstand Cricket Podcast with your boys Corbin Middlemass and former Australian opening batter Ed Cowan. And Teddy, last week we spoke to you. You were in the car in Canberra. As I look at you on my Zoom, our listeners won't be able to see this, but I can. You are in an automobile again, but even more sort of casual than what you were last week with the sun hat on and the shirt. Where on earth are you at the moment as we record this edition of the pod?
It's a family beach day today, Corb. Oh. And look, I'll go to no length is too long not to make sure that our cricket nerds get their weekly fix of what's going on in Australian cricket and around the world. It's the time of year that cricket has to be top of mind. So I'm happy to sit in this car, currently about 43 degrees, aircon's off. So the sweating up a storm to make sure that we cover the big issues.
I'm looking forward to it. Better than race it along and move towards the big stuff straight away. The test match, Ed, is only a couple of days away. It's at the Sydney Cricket Ground. And who'd have thunk it? There's a bit of rain forecast. What's going on with your El Nino sort of effect? That feels like every single year the rain comes during the Sydney test match. I was lucky enough to live in Sydney for a couple of years. Loved it. I try and tell people all the time it's the best climate in Australia. The best winter you could possibly experience is in Sydney. And then the summer always turns it on. But for whatever reason, when Sydney is showcased to the country for 5 days every year, it feels like it always bloody rains in early January.
La Nina, I think, rather than El Nino. So let's just make sure that we've got our weather patterns correct.
Whatever it is.
Yeah. I mean, the oddity being that this entire week has been 28 degrees, not a cloud in the sky, families flocking to Bondi, and then literally it doesn't matter what day of the test they move it to. It used to be the 3rd, it would rain. Now they've moved it to the 5th. It's as though the cricket gods are not particularly happy with the SCG. Maybe they know that the wicket's going to be average and they say, you know what, we're not even going to put you through this. But you're right, the forecast isn't great, as in it's going to pour for 5 days, and reminds me of the test against the West Indies not so long ago when I can't remember. I think it was almost washed out without a ball being bowled. So let's keep our fingers crossed, because you know the 5-0 whitewash is still on the cards. If the sun can shine, I don't know, maybe just for 2.5 days. Well, that's all they need, maybe 3.
There's a lot to talk about on the England side of things. The Aussies, meanwhile, as we forecast last week, the inevitable storyline leading into the Sydney Test match about whether we're going to play the dual spinners. And so we've had all the chat this week about, does Mitch Swepson play at this opportunity? There is a hole in the lineup, so there will be at least one change, potentially more, with Travis Head contracting COVID-19. So as a result, he's out of the Test match. What changes do you forecast in the Australian team, Ed, as we head towards Sydney?
Well, I think Khawaja will come in for Head. So let's just put that to one side. And as you say, the talk of playing two spinners as though the SCG has been a dust bowl like it was back in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and it's certainly not the case. So I think the composition of the team will largely remain the same, but it's so hard to know how the fast bowlers have pulled up. Not that they've done a heap of work in the last test match, but if Hazelwood's fit, you'd imagine him to come back in, maybe at the expense of Bolan, but my goodness, that would be an awkward conversation to have with Scott if that was the case and you're the chairman of selectors. Or maybe they rest Mitch Stark, but it is his home test match. So without knowing how their bodies are, without knowing exactly the fitness levels, you feel as though the composition is going to be the same. That is, unless the SCG wicket is an absolute barren, you know, desert. But there's no reason for it to be that. You know, they've been trying to get some grass back on that square for the test match. I saw some video not so long ago, and it looked as though there was some live grass. So fingers crossed there is. And if that's the case, you can't imagine the leg spinner playing. And all this talk, and I don't know what you think, give Swepson a game, he's going to be used in the subcontinent. Two of the next three series are away from home. Three of the next four series are away from home. Get some experience into him. I don't like that chat whatsoever, because you need to be picking your best team for the conditions for every test match. And if he's not making the 11 based on that criteria, the give him a go and make sure that you get his first test out of the way, it doesn't rub that well with me. But keen to get the layman view.
Well, I guess the the theory is that, I mean, that the preparation for these tours isn't what it used to be. So it's not like you go over there early and you play a bunch of trial games or tour games and then you lead into the test series in familiar conditions. So, I mean, the series is... So if you look at it, if it was any other sport and wasn't cricket and we talk about, you know, how important the baggy green is and playing test cricket for Australia and all those things are true, that this is essentially two test matches that are dead. The next major task for Australian cricket is to win in the subcontinent. But I agree in the sense that if you're going to play Swepson, you may as well play Nick Maddison and pick a whole team that's suited to playing against spin. But then you're not playing on a spin-friendly wicket against an opponent that has a really good spinner. So how much preparation are they actually getting for those conditions by playing a one-off test in Sydney or using the Hobart test as somewhat of preparation for later tours? So it's really hard to try and... to set up that scenario just because that's the next major tour that they need to win.
Yeah, I agree with that. And then the next step along is, oh, you need to, and I, again, don't buy into that, you have to earn the baggy green. Well, Mitch Swepson would have earned his baggy green. He's dominated chilled cricket for the best part of 2 years. He's, as you said last week, he's spun Queensland to a couple of dramatic wins, one at the MCG last year that I think you're in fact present for. So, if when he does play, and he will play cricket for Australia, he would have earned that right. And so there are far worse spinners that have played cricket for Australia in the last 20 years that, you know, perhaps don't lay that claim as well as Mitch Swepson does. So it's an interesting talking point. It feels like we have it every first week of January. There's no doubt he'll get a go on the subcontinent and we'll see his wares there.
What do you think of the convoy that made its way from Melbourne to Sydney? So Marcus Harris, along with Mitch Marsh and Josh Inglis, my understanding is took three separate cars, drove one after another on a three-car convoy from Melbourne to Sydney to sort of keep themselves away from the general public on a commercial airline or even away from one another. Marcus Harris was really the concern after he dined with Travis Head on the Wednesday night, and obviously Travis returned a positive COVID-19 test thereafter. What do you think of that mode of transport for three of our Australian cricketers?
You've been following the news a bit closer than I have because I was not aware of that. I hope they stopped at the Paragon Cafe in Goulburn because that is a fantastic road stop. That's the best. I mean, if you're travelling the Hume Highway, Corb, you've got to have a chicken schnitzel at the Paragon Cafe in Goulburn. I think Timmy Rogers from UMI, in fact, sang a song about the Paragon Cafe. But, I mean, why not? Well, I mean, airline travel these days, you're going to wait at the other end, or you might as well take 10 hours in a single car convoy.
Mm. Well, my first question was, what happened to Pat Cummins' private jet when he was at, when he was actually a close...
You've got to remember where the pecking order falls. Oh, Marcus Harris has sneezed out 72 runs. Pat Cummins, the Australian Test captain.
Boy, was that on
display. To fly by private jet.
Boy, was that on display here. Pat Cummins, who was actually a close contact, as deemed by South Australian Health, compared to Marcus Harris, who we're just, along with Mitch Marsh and Josh Inglis, who are just taking precautions, and we have a three-car convoy for 9 hours to prepare for a test match in a car versus a private jet to get home to Sydney so you can quarantine in more luxurious surrounds. The England team, you put this on the radar nice and early about the expose on England cricket, and it's amazing to have seen the reaction, particularly here, as much as what's taken place back in the UK. But I spoke to Ellie Mitchell, of course, part of our team on Grandstand Cricket yesterday, about what needs to change with England cricket.
I think we're now seeing that the long-term impact is where the county championship has been sidelined to either end of the English season. And you look at the way the Australian summer is structured, and the Sheffield Shield is the same. It's played at the start and then there are blocks and then it's purely Big Bash going on while the test summer is in progress. And then we'll see the Shield come back in. The difference between the two countries is obviously the climate. And when county championship cricket is played at the front and back end of the English summer, in April, it is cold. It is often pretty damp still. Gosh, it had snow often at the start of the season in April. Yeah. But pitches are green, the ball's nipping around. Same when you get to the back end of September as well. It's got that autumnal feel to it. And medium pace bowlers can get the ball to dibble and dobble around, can take wickets, and batters don't often get a chance even to bat for long periods. And certainly they don't get that opportunity to bat for long periods with the sun on their back on, you know, good pitches and just those levels of concentration that are needed to compile big scores of 100, 150 plus. And yes, some batsmen, of course, have clocked those up against their names, but not on the level of consistency that is needed to forge a successful top six batting order.
It has been quite interesting, the reaction to how England have gone here. And you expressed this on this podcast really a couple of times throughout the series so far about the importance that the England need to be good for the Ashes to be an interesting series. And it's so important for Test cricket. Whereas, you know, if Australia came out here and beat up on Pakistan or Sri Lanka, I don't think there would be this kind of interest in the losing opposition setup as to how sort of cricket functions in that part of the world like there has been in the Australian press in recent days.
Without doubt, and it was predictable, and as I say, we alluded to it, that this was going to start the chatter of the structure of the northern summer. And I think, I mean, it's almost a bellwether. That domestic construct is almost a bellwether of the game in itself. Everyone looks to England as a place, you know, the history is steeped there. What are they doing with their county system? Is it slow to react or are they on pace? And you could turn back the clock 20 years and you'd still have the same conversation. It's not necessarily about T20 or the 100. It was always about there are too many teams. And 20 county teams, the quality isn't high enough. And so it's not producing good enough standards of cricket. Then they went to two divisions. But it was propped up with the international players. And all of a sudden, the conversation's based around the structure of the season. And that's not to say that we have the structure of the season perfect here, but there has been a lot of tinkering to try and optimise for both commercial arrangements and development aspects. So, yeah, it's a fascinating conversation to have, and it feels like we need to dig into it at some point. But how they structure it across 20 teams, they've now got two short formats. I forget the one day is. They've got a T20 format and the 100 coexisting. And so there are four formats of cricket over the summer. And as Ali said, unless you're playing usually in the south of the country and at a great wicket like the Oval and Surrey, there is very little opportunity early in the year to score big runs. And often we see, you know, the batsmen migrate to those counties to try and put some runs on the board. And Rory Burns, the case in point, he obviously grew up down the road, but plays for Surrey, does get big runs. Ollie Pope's another one, plays in the south of the country. And so they are players that get the opportunity to score some runs on some good wickets all year round.
I mean, the changes for the team as we head towards Sydney, we touched on this in the last edition of the pod, that it doesn't, they're not going to bring in any sort of superstar sort of batting strength that's going to help them significantly in the areas where they've been exposed. So sure, we might see a different collection of the quicks and Leach will probably play. But it feels like whatever changes they make isn't really going to address the issue that they have at the moment.
No, you're right. And I think we mentioned if I was, you know, part of their setup, you'd want Ollie Pope to be playing. I know there was talk of protecting him from future tours, but there's no time like a dead rubber in Australia to be breeding players. So, you know, maybe when they're looking back, they did the same for Joe Root a few tours ago. That would have been better. Him gaining more experience in Australian conditions. So there isn't a hell of a lot of class mucking around their batting scene. One person that every time I watch bat for Sydney Thunder, Sam Billings, you think, wow, he's got sparkling feet, fast hands. I know it's a different format of the game, but I could do with a little bit of innovative ball striking, someone who can, you know, he has had some first-class success to bat at five or six and actually put some pressure on the Australians with the sound technique. So unfortunately, or fortunately for Sydney Thunder fans, he's currently playing with them, but he's someone that you just look at their lineup and think, oh, there's a bit of class lacking. Maybe he could provide the spark.
He's about to go home too, so they've got that ridiculous scenario that Australia found themselves in a few years ago where their T20 white ball team is going to sort of overlap with their test team, where you've got two national teams representing England playing at the same time. So a bunch of the English international players that are out here in the Big Bash are heading home prematurely, unfortunately, for that, and Billings falls in that category. Just last one on the Sydney test then, Ed, how much time's enough? So if there are thunderstorms forecast throughout, how much time do the Aussies need to be able to take 20 wickets and win the test?
They'd need 3.5 days of cricket, I think, for Australia to win.
3.5 days.
It really just depends on the quality of the wicket. If it's slow and turgid like it has been in previous years, they'll need 7.5 days and they won't get that. So who knows until they pull back the covers for the toss of the coin. Talk to me on Wednesday.
COVID conversations are very boring and we know that they're dominating Australian life, so we don't want to bog you down too much in this podcast on that front. Obviously, the way that it's being handled by sport is a talking point, and it's ravaged the Big Bash in recent days. So there are 23 positive cases as we record this across three different teams, four players from the Sydney Thunder, one from the Perth Scorchers, and 18 members of the Melbourne Stars organisation at the moment, eight support staff and 10 players. I spoke to Blair Crouch on Summer Grandstand yesterday, the general manager of the Stars, about the health of those 18 individuals.
Thankfully, the severity of the symptoms has been relatively good. We certainly haven't had any hospitalisations. There's probably varying levels of symptoms across the group, but certainly we've been probably fortunate that each of the people affected have been able to be managed from either within home or within hotel isolation. So therefore, that's probably been one of the very few positives that have come out of the last couple of days.
So one game postponed out on December 30. December 31, more positive cases for the Sydney Thunder. The game went ahead. And then yesterday, by hook or by crook, which was Sunday, the game went ahead as well with replacement players called in. And the Big Bash doing the right thing by sort of continuing on despite the positive cases bobbing up?
Yeah, I think so. I think that the show's got to go on, particularly it's only 7 days quarantine now. So, you know, usually this time of year, games are staged out and you'd probably only find a team playing once, maybe twice in the week. Ironically, the word from the Stars camp is, I was speaking to a player, how did this all unfold? They had a team meeting in a small room in a hotel about COVID protocols and irony being that they all got sick. But look, it gives an opportunity to some other players. And we saw that with Tom Rogers yesterday with the Stars, you know, really take an opportunity that otherwise hadn't been presented to him. We saw the Thunder actually, go about their business a bit differently tactically. You know, they had a few people out, but all of a sudden Ben Cutting's opening the innings and, you know, they've shown their versatility in the last two games, albeit against a weak Strikers team, to actually take some initiative and say, you know, we've got 11 players and everyone's good enough to perform. I don't think best cricketers are that far off the standard of most of the Big Bash anyway. And so it's not as though it's a fully fledged international competition there. They might be 10 or 15% down on the pace, but as we saw yesterday, you can step up and on good wickets really showcase some skills. Club cricket's good cricket. If you go down to any suburban first grade ground on a Saturday, you see some bloody good cricketers. And given the opportunity, it's actually nice to see them have the opportunity to flourish.
The great cricketer boys, I'm sure, would have been inundated with messages yesterday as the Stars were still trying to piece together 11, 12, 13 players to cobble together a squad on the morning of the game in a professional game of cricket. So I'm sure cricketers right across the country, Ed, would have been in that position in the past where you're sort of making phone calls last minute thinking, gee, who can we possibly get in to pull an 11 together today?
Well, there were three of their players who weren't even in the state at the start of the day. And so, I mean, someone like Justin Avedano, who's a very strong T20 player, has played quite a bit of cricket with the Sixers. There's a good example. He's sitting on his bum doing nothing. You know, he can add some flavour to the Big Bash. And so I think the game's got to go on. We're now in a position that it's not as though it's not as though the vaccinated population in amongst the players. We've heard that the symptoms aren't as bad as amongst the players as what we think. And so the financial implications of missing those games is too great to bear.
All right. By the time the Stars play the Renegades on January 3, every team in the competition would have played 8 games. So we've just passed the halfway stage. I know you wanted to get into a little bit of Big Bash chat. Is there something that's caught your eye, Ed, that you want to lead us off with? The ladder as it looks at the moment, the Scorchers and the Sixers both out on top. Then the Sydney Thunder have given themselves a game, a gap in third spot. Then the Hobart Hurricanes still in finals contention. And the Brisbane Heat bobbing up now. So them and the Stars both on 3 wins, with Adelaide and the Renegades languishing down the bottom with just 1 win each.
Yeah, the gulf's expanding. The Strikers and the Renegades, you know, we said on paper that didn't look that strong, and all of a sudden their form is proving that, and you're seeing little things creep into their game that suggests maybe they've got one foot out the door already. You know, their fielding's been pretty average. I think the story of the week is actually the Sydney Thunder. They beat a fully-fledged Scorchers team in Manuka, a great game of cricket, and really flexed some muscle there. And then, you know, a few days later, under some duress with 4 players out, as I said, managed to manipulate their tactics to win at the Adelaide Oval on New Year's Eve. And the big story there for me is the 3 youngsters, Jilks, Sanger and Ollie Davies, flourishing under Trevor Bayliss. And so this is a bit of a storyline I think is worth exploring. The benefit of having a world-class coach, and that is TB has laid claim to that for over a day. He's won a World Cup, he's won IPLs, you name it, he's done it. He's a world-class coach, and there aren't many of them in the world. Comes with a young and somewhat inexperienced Thunder team, and their youngsters are now flourishing. And so it's a nice little case study, actually. We always talk about maybe the best coaches should be with the national team. As you see with Greg Shepherd, and he likens himself to a primary school teacher. It's actually giving those youngsters the skills in developing their game so that they are ready for international cricket. And so giving them the confidence and the game sense. Sanger at the Adelaide Oval was absolutely brilliant. It was a bit of a slow start, but once he got going, that was as good a T20 innings you could possibly play. Anyone could play. And he's not a T20 player by any stretch of the imagination. Jilks last night. Ollie Davies playing the shot of what could be the shot of the year, back foot cover drive for 6 off Rashid Khan. So these, you know, highly talented youngsters coming together under a good coach and a good culture and flourishing. And so that's certainly a storyline for the week for mine. And the other one's just about the Stars. I think there's something wrong inherently with that club at the moment. And let's put COVID to one side. They just haven't performed. And been watching closely the last couple of weeks. Just the way Maxwell captains the team is reminds me a lot of Shane Warne. It's very gut feel. It's very roll the dice a lot of the time. You know, a lot of the other captains are very strategic. It's almost as though they're playing chess, you know, pushing people out and matchups and how to manipulate certain parts of the game. Where Maxwell's, it's like he's at the poker table and he's just trying to hit the bid the whole time. So that's another little storyline that, you know, maybe it's not this year that it really gets exposed, but I don't know if that club can be as good as it should be while he's captaining the team.
Can you just expand a little more on that, Ed? So what do you mean by that with Glenn Maxwell, where, you know, he's playing poker and the others are playing chess? What sort of, I guess, a couple of the things that you notice in his captaincy?
Well, I mean, I'll go to a few examples in a second, but often he's mic'd up and the commentators will go to him and say, oh, you know, why is such and such bowling? He said, oh, I just had a feeling. And, you know, often the captains would say that out of, you know, guardedness. They don't want to give too much away. You generally get the sense that with Maxwell, it is a feeling and he is very much a gut feel captain, which is fine. That's very much how he plays his cricket. He's an instinct type player. But you do get the sense that sometimes in regards to his field play, not necessarily field placings, but where people are up and back to different players in different parts of the game, he's always looking for the extra attacking option. And sometimes in T20 cricket, to attack is to defend. And the fielding 20 overs is about defense and how well you can manipulate your defense. And at certain points during that 20 overs, you can attack, where Maxwell is all out attack. And you need to be watching the game closely to notice this. And I don't necessarily think that suits the style of play that they're trying to play. So I'm not picking on Glenn Maxwell, because it's up to him to score runs, up to Zamp to take wickets and Stoinis to score runs as their big players, and or Dre Russ or whoever's around. But it does make a difference. It might be a 5% difference, but in T20, 5% is a lot. We're talking about games that are often coming down to 6 balls or 7 balls, and 5% makes a big difference.
A couple of things I saw this week. I saw the X factor actually work, Ed, which we haven't seen that sort of too often. The game between the Heat and the Hurricanes, where the Heat were in all sorts of trouble. They were 5 for not many, and then soon after they pulled the trigger on the X factor, they were 6 for 50, I think, when Jack Wildermuth came out to bat at number 8. He made 20-odd, but he batted for a long period of time, and Baisley was able to catch fire around him, and they ended up cobbling together from 6 for 50. They got to 150, and it ended up being a match-winning score by about 14 runs against the Hobart Hurricanes. So that's something we haven't seen all that often, but that's exactly how it should work. That, look, we need to save the game now. We're at 5 for 50. We need more batting. And so they took out one of their bowlers. They put Wildermuth in. Obviously, the added benefit that he can bowl a little bit of seam up for him as well. And they sort of ran out of options at different stages as well with the ball, but they had enough on the ball that they were good enough to win the game at the end. So I did like that, I must admit. A couple of other things that I saw this weekend too. One is the television umpire referring to the boundary rope as the Toblerone, which I know the TV commentators picked up. I'd never heard it before in my life, and now I'm only referring it to that for the remainder of my life when I see the Toblerone on the boundary line. And the last thing is the conversation around Sean Abbott and Jake Fraser-McGurk as to who took the best catch in the Big Bash this year. And I am an unabashed fan of both, as you know, Ed. Tell me, who took the best catch in the Big Bash so far this year? Fraser McGurk's effort on the boundary line, or the reflex diving catch horizontal effort from Sabah up inside the ring?
I'd almost put Sabah's catch as the best catch in the history of the Big Bash. And the only other one that comes to mind, is Jordan Silk at the Gabba. Craig Kiedswetter absolutely smashed one down the ground, and he took a similar style catch. The difference being, one is reflex, and you still have to move. And so to take 2 steps and to fully time your catch, where Fraser McGurk has 5, 6, 7 seconds to judge when to leap, when to raise his hand, and when to land. And so they're two very separate catches, both brilliant. And Fraser McGurk was a hell of a catch. That's a 10 out of 10 catch. But Sabah's is a 1 in 10 years kind of catch. That was as good a catch as you'll ever see in any format of the game. And he had an absolute day out. He bowled well. He won the game with the bat. That was single-handedly just a brilliant display. But, you know, hopefully next year, just back to the Toblerone, you know, everyone's favourite chocolate could end up being a sponsor. Why wouldn't they sponsor the road? Get the silly betting agencies out and the Swiss chocolate in, I say.
Yep, I'm with you. It's a missed opportunity. No changes to my bracket this week, so I'm going to hold firm again for one more week. So I'm not sure about the Sydney Thunder or the Melbourne Stars, but I'm starting to think I may need to move the Thunder up. Top bracket, I've still got the Hurricanes, the Scorchers and the Sixers, and down the bottom, the Heat, the Gades and the Strikers. So third week in a row, I'm going with the same bracket. I've only made one change for the season so far, and that was to put the Thunder up and the Heat down. But watch this space. I may have to make a change by the time we get to next week. Ed, enjoy the Sydney Test. Are you on board duties out at the cricket with the New South Wales board? Do you have to head along for Are you heading along for a couple of days?
I think they call it hobnobbing around at the Test match. yes, I will be. Hopefully we get some cricket, because it is a great spectacle just a wonderful Test match that has provided a lot of happy memories for not only myself, but many other Sydney-siders. So fingers crossed we can get it away.
Now, all the very best with that. Enjoy the day at the beach. I see you sweating up in the car. I'd be very keen to get out. We got through it with, had to turn the aircon on halfway through, but you made it to the end.
It's been worth sweating up a storm in this little shoebox in a car, Corby. Can't wait till next week. I promise I'll have my microphone ready. We'll be in some air-conditioned comfort and you'll get them.
Just like that, the Zoom recording runs out right at the finish, but he'll be back next week. This is the Grandstand Cricket Podcast.